session. And it is truly a delight to introduce our first speaker. I've been going to ASA meetings for about 15 years now, every year. And this is the primary meeting I go through for the year. And it's a combination of two things. Yeah, I work in the area of science and religion. But it's the fellowship aspect that I am so blessed. I mean, I come here and then I get on the plane 3 days later and I'm wiped right out because I don't get any sleep because I'm meeting everyone and I'm blessed to no end. And this is your first year here. I'll certainly encourage you to consider coming a few years in a row and you'll know what I mean. It's an absolute share and wrestle with some of these ideas. Well, Paul Seeley, I've known Paul Seeley for 12 years now. He is a mentor, a friend, and a wonderful academic colleague. He did his training at Westminster Theological Seminary, and in 1989 published what I consider one of the most important science-religion books in terms of wrestling with the hermeneutics of the science and scripture entitled, and I love the title, Inerrant Wisdom, subtitled Science and Biblical Inerrancy in Perspective, and I'd certainly encourage you to get a copy of that. Now, when I look at Paul's publishing career, I think of a series of papers that showed up in the Westminster Theological Journal. And for those of you in the literature of science, religion, hermeneutics, how do you interpret the scriptures, Paul's papers in 91 on the firmament, and then in 92 on the waters above, and 97 on the meaning of scripture, are standard stuff, and they get cited over and over again. He's had a huge impact, and I think of a good friend at Wheaton College, John Walton, who's been absolutely blessed by Paul's work. Paul has contributed to our journal over 10 papers, and in particular, a recent debate with Hugh Ross and the issue of concordism. So my dear brother, Paul, please come forward and share a few ideas on, does the Bible use phenomenological language? Phenomenal language.
Thank you, Dennis. Treat to see y'all. Got to say y'all once. Although I learned that you're supposed to say in a group, all y'all. So, first question on this beginning point here is simply, what is phenomenal language? And to define it, we'll take some examples. Calvin dealing with Genesis 1:16. God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night, and made the stars also. Prior to the rise of modern astronomy, this was understood to mean that the sun was literally the largest heavenly body, the moon was second largest, and the stars were the smallest of all. Augustine referred to this verse as evidence that the stars really are as small as they appear. But in Calvin's time, astronomy proved that one star, namely Saturn, was larger than the moon. This caused unbelievers to scoff at the Bible. So Calvin said that in Genesis 1:16, Moses spoke about the sun and the moon, quote, in a popular manner, according to their appearance to the uneducated, rather than according to truth. Appearance as opposed to truth. In his Institutes, Calvin wrote, Moses did not intend to provide a precise scientific description, but rather a perfectly accurate description of how the world appears to the human eye, so as not to confuse the common people. Appearance as opposed to a scientific description. In the mid-19th century, the Calvinist theologian Charles Hodge said, the language of the Bible is the language of common life, and the language of common life is founded on apparent and not upon scientific truth. It would be ridiculous to refuse to speak of the sun rising and setting because we know that it is not a satellite of our planet. Apparent versus scientific truth. In the mid-20th century, Bernard Ram wrote, the Bible uses a language which is restricted to the apparent, and the Bible does not theorize as to the actual nature of things. The apparent as opposed to the actual nature of things. We can gather from these cases that phenomenal language, evangelical theology, is language which describes the appearance of things as opposed to the actual nature of things. The appearance in contradistinction to the reality. The second thing we need to discuss briefly is the historical grammatical interpretation of Scripture. In order to answer the question of whether there is phenomenal language in the Bible, we need to interpret the Bible. The crux of a valid interpretation is grammatical. That is, of words change time and Scripture. It's never when interpreting a document from a different time period or a different culture to interpret it in the light of the meanings of words and of concepts as they were understood at the time the document was written. Charles Hodge understood this, and he made his first rule of interpreting the Bible, and I quote, "The words of Scripture are to be taken in their plain historical sense." That is, they must be taken in the sense attached to them in the age and by the people to whom they were addressed. The question of whether the Bible speaks of the firmament and of the sun's rising and setting is truth or language must be determined by interpreting the relevant texts within their historical context. Part 3. The solid firmament in Genesis 1, is it phenomenal language? Standard Hebrew lexicons define rakiach, which is the Hebrew word for firmament, as, quote, a solid expanse, quote, or a firm vault of heaven. The conservative Reformed theologian Charles Hodge taught Hebrew for 20 years before he began teaching theology. When he read the word rakiach in Genesis 1, he recognized that the word was speaking of a solid sky. A century later, another theologically conservative scholar of Hebrew, Edward J. Young, defined rakiach as that which is hammered or beaten out, and he noted the Septuagint translation of stereoma and the Vulgate translation firmamentum, both of which imply solidity, are, quote, satisfactory renderings, unquote. This is all the more remarkable from E.J. Young, since he was committed to absolute biblical inerrancy and wrote a book, Thy Word is Truth, defending the idea that any statement in the Bible about science would be inerrant. We, of course, have today John Walton, who is certainly conservative, evangelical, and recognizes that rakiach is a reference to a solid sky. The question before us is not, is the firmament in Genesis 1 solid? The question before us is that solidity merely phenomenal language? For the sky appears at night to be solid. Further, when Charles Hodge was asked why the Bible speaks of a solid sky, when in fact we know it's not solid, he quoted a passage from Calvin to the effect that this statement in the Bible was an accommodation. One might suppose, as I once did, that he meant an accommodation to the scientific beliefs of the times. But a close look at Hodge's work indicates that he was saying the solid sky mentioned in Genesis was an accommodation to the sky's appearance. The interesting thing about Hodge's idea that the solid firmament in Genesis 1 is phenomenal language is that it violates Hodge's own first rule of interpretation. Namely, that words mean what they meant to the people of that time, and people in the time of the Old Testament believed the sky was really solid. When they spoke of the solid sky, they meant it literally. Egyptian texts speak of the sky being held up by a god, or supported by a mountain, or some other kind of support. Egyptologist John Wilson said, Egyptians would consider a sky to be dangerous if it did not have any visible means of support. Babylonian texts name the kind of rock the sky was believed to be made of. A Hittite text speaks of the sky having originally been separated from the earth with a cleaver. In fact, pre-scientific peoples everywhere have all but universally spoken of the sky as literally solid, even employing it to explain various natural phenomena. There was an Indian tribe in America who, seeing that the firmament is a dome, and a solid dome, explained that when that dome goes up and down, like a bellows, that's what causes wind. So if you didn't ever know what causes wind before, we now know. The belief that the sky really was solid was, in fact, nearly universal until the time of modern astronomy. This historical context tells us that when people in the Old Testament spoke of the solid sky, they meant it literally, not as phenomenal language. Old Testament verses like Ezekiel 1:22 through 26, which speak of a solid rakiak, and Job 37:18, which calls the sky hard as a molten mirror, reflect the ancient view that the sky really was solid. We conclude, therefore, that the solidity of the firmament in the Old Testament was not phenomenal language, but was understood as literal reality. Part 4, is the rising and setting of the sun in the Bible phenomenal language? This is the one you always hear about. In the mid-19th century, again, go back to Charles Hodge, he wrote, "Men instinctively form their language according to apparent and not absolute or scientific truth. They speak of the sun as rising and setting, of its running its course through the heavens, although they know that this is only apparent and not really true. The language of the Bible on this, as well as on other subjects, is framed in accordance with the common usage of men." I think Hodge is inferring rather clearly that when the Bible speaks of the sun moving, it is just using phenomenal language. In evangelical writings, you find that position espoused many times. And when a phenomenal language is appealed to, it usually ends up with a statement that even we who know better scientifically still speak of sunset and sunrise. So regarding such statements in the Bible as phenomenal language is certainly justified. This idea is accepted very readily because from our knowledge of modern science, it is unthinkable to regard the sun as literally moving. But suppose a person is speaking of the sun rising or setting who does not have our knowledge of modern science. There's no reason for them to think the sun is not literally moving. They may use the same words we do, but if they think the sun is literally moving, then we have no right to label their statement as phenomenal language. Suppose I said I saw an airplane rise into the heaven and later come down and set down. I'm using similar words to what I use to speak about the movement of the sun. But I would certainly be upset if someone said I was only using phenomenal language. This is a real airplane that is literally moving. So the question is, when the Bible speaks of a sun rising or setting, is the writer speaking about appearances, or is he speaking about the sun literally moving? Using the historical grammatical method of interpretation, we must ask, what is the historical sense of these words? What did they mean in Old Testament times? In Old Testament times, the Egyptians thought of the sun's motion as literal rather than as mere appearance. We know this because they often wrote about the journey of the sun at night. The noted Egyptologist Eric Hornung tells us the Egyptian Book of Gates is concerned with the nocturnal journey of the sun. He also says the theme of the Egyptian Book of Caverns is the nightly journey of the sun through the netherworld. And the Egyptians called the Amduat, which is the Egyptian name for the underworld, describes the journey of the sun god through the 12 hours of the night, from his setting to his rising in the morning. The Egyptologist John Wilson tells us, the snake Apophis, which is frequently encountered in literature attacking or opposing the sun, is the hostile darkness which the sun defeats every night through the netherworld, from the place of the sunset in the west to the place of the sunrise in the east. We see from the fact that the sun is given a detailed description of its journey at night, when it cannot be seen by our eyes, through the underworld, which also cannot be seen by our eyes, from the east to the west, that this is talking about a literal motion of the sun and not a phenomenal description of it. In Old Testament times, in Mesopotamia, people again thought of the sun as literally moving, as is evidenced again by their belief that the sun continued traveling at night. As the Sumerologist Kramer noted, the Sumerian sages held the view that the sun, after setting, continued its journey through the netherworld. Another scholar says, according to one tradition, the sun god, after crossing the skies by day, spent the night traveling through the underworld. In a hymn to Shamash, the sun god, we read, to distant stretches which are not known and uncounted leagues, Shamash, you work ceaselessly, going by day and returning by night. We can see then that as occurred in Egypt, the sun in Mesopotamia was described as traveling at night through the underworld from the west back to its starting place in the east. Since this part of the sun's journey was not visible to the eye, the language cannot be one of appearance. It must be phenomenal language. This belief that the sun literally moved, traveling at night under the earth back to the place where it started in the morning, was the standard belief of people for hundreds of years. It lasted well into Christian times. At the beginning of the Christian era, we read in 2 Enoch, thus he, the sun, goes through a cycle, and he goes down and he rises up across the sky and beneath the earth. The Greek geographer Strabo, about the same time, wrote, whenever a revolution of the universe produces a day and night, because at one time the sun moves beneath the earth and at another time above the earth. Philo, a Jewish contemporary of the Apostle Paul, wrote, because every period of time is a series of days and nights, and these can only be made such by the movement of the sun as it goes over and under the earth. The people of the ancient world, from Old Testament times to New Testament times, and on until the coming of Copernicus, understood the sun to be literally moving. The historical grammatical interpretation of Scripture, then, is that the words of Scripture relating to the movement of the sun are literal, not phenomenal language. Ecclesiastes 1:5 confirms that Scripture is speaking of a literal moving of the sun when it says, quote, the sun rises and goes down and hurries to the place where it rises. As long as we interpret the Old Testament within its historical context, there's no question that the language used of the sun's movement is literal, not phenomenal, and Ecclesiastes 1:5 confirms this. There's also another, hardly ever mentioned, interesting indication that the Old Testament is not using phenomenal language. This indication is the fact that the Old Testament never speaks of the visual phenomenon of the sun going down. When referring to the sun rising, the Old Testament regularly uses the Hebrew word Allah, which means to go up. Simply as a word, it could refer to the movement of the sun, either literally or as phenomenal language. We only know it's literal from its historical context. But when speaking of the sun's movement in the afternoon, the original Hebrew never uses a Hebrew word meaning go down. The primary Hebrew word, yarad, which is used over 350 times to mean go down with regard to other subjects, is never used of the sun. Instead, when speaking of the sun going down, that's the way it's often translated at least, a Hebrew word is used that is used nearly 2,000 times, but never to mean go down, is used of the sun. The primary meaning of this Hebrew word is to enter. The reference is, in context we would deduce, to the sun's movement leaving this world to enter the underworld to begin its trip back to the east. Psalm 51 speaks of the earth from the rising of the sun, literally, unto its entrance. Babylonian texts similarly speak of what we call sunset as, quote, the entrance of the sun. And the implication, I think, is that the Bible is, again, not talking about phenomenal language, but of a literal journey of the sun into the underworld and back so it can start its next morning's work. I believe it's clear that the statements in the Bible about a solid sky and the movement of the sun are not phenomenal language. But the question arises, does the Bible use phenomenal language with regard to something else? Does the Bible ever use phenomenal language? I do not think so. The reason people in Bible times thought of the sky as solid and the sun as literally moving is because the sky looks solid, especially at night, and the sun looks like it is literally moving. They accepted the appearance as the reality. Phenomenal language demands that one oppose the appearance to the reality, just the opposite of what they did. So although I'm not quite ready to say there is no phenomenal language in the Bible, I would say it is doubtful, and that we should not accept the idea that there is phenomenal language in the Bible until someone sets forth objective evidence that a biblical writer referred to an appearance as opposed to the physical reality. So what we come down to here is that this in the scriptures, the sky is regarded as literally solid, and the sun is regarded as literally moving, and that makes a bit of a problem for biblical inerrancy. So what do we do now? Well, if biblical inerrancy, or biblical inspiration, perhaps we should say, is defined in a rigidly rationalistic manner, so that the Bible cannot make a false statement about science, even when it was not God's intention to teach science, then the solid sky and literally moving sun, which we find in the Bible, must either be taken out of context and rationalized away as phenomenal language, or interpreted in context and recognized as evidence that the Bible is not absolutely inerrant, that is, inerrant with regard to all of its statements of science. If, on the other hand, biblical inspiration is defined biblically, so that the teaching of Jesus that the Old Testament divorce laws involving a concession to sinfulness is accepted, then I can see no reason why the Old Testament cannot contain concessions to the science of the times. This would mean that scientific matters like the nature of the sky or the literal movement of the sun can be accepted as divine accommodations which leave the intended message of God inerrant, and the Bible can still be defined as inerrant. I like to use the phrase inerrant for the purpose for which it was written. Now, that's the major paper. I just want to make a couple other notes. The copies that I made on the first page have this quotation from Charles Hodge, which at the last minute I finally discovered was really from Calvin. So you might want to scratch that. But not a great deal of difference. I'm sure Hodge wouldn't have been offended. But it is an incorrect statement. A second thing that should be mentioned is that the movement of the sun at night through the underworld is the dominant idea in Mesopotamia and Egypt. It is not the only idea. There is a second idea, and that is that the sun, instead of going invisibly under the earth, goes invisibly over the top of the firmament and comes back down. So that is a secondary position that is presented in the literature. I didn't bring it up because it doesn't change anything with regard to phenomenal language.
You did bring it up.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Sorry. I didn't write it down. Yes, I didn't write it down. I should have said. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's ready for questions or comments or whatever.
We've got lots of time.
Dennis, why don't you pick out people for answering questions and then...
Dr. Gray.
Thanks, Paul. What if your distinction between phenomenal and literal is overplayed here?
It is what?
Overplayed. What if all language is phenomenal?
If I'm missing this here.
If all language is phenomenal.
What if all language is phenomenal?
And that, you know, the distinction that we're making and that has been made between phenomenal and literal, or, you know, you're talking about mere appearances
right.
as phenomenal. I mean, you really seem to be
focused there.
Understating or having a little bit of a disregard of the phenomenal. But language is phenomenal. You know, it's we talk about what we see, what we experience, and as we learn more and experience more, say in modern science, that becomes part of the phenomenon.
There is a sense in which you could say that, yeah.
And so, it shouldn't be any surprise that the ancients really believed that what they were seeing, that the appearance. And the way they described it was what they thought was really happening, because that's what we always do.
You're right. It's perfectly natural.
And so I guess I'm not, I don't see that you've undone the power of the argument for phenomenal language by making this big disconnection between them.
Well, the case was made by Calvin and Hodge and Ram, and I'm just going with it.
Well, right, but it's always phenomenal.
Well, you write that out for me, Terry, and maybe I can think about that. I just don't know. You know, the distinction usually is made because of the coming of modern science, and especially was made to get rid of the problem with Copernicus. I think that's where it really began to be stressed, is that the Bible is just saying a phenomenal thing. It's not really literal about the sun moving. They wanted to do something to allow Copernicus to be heard. And I think that's
right,
where it began.
Even the fact that you're using words just, it's just phenomenal.
Yes.
Or merely, or...
Yes.
Your distinguishment between literal and phenomenal.
Well, that's what you'll find in all the rest of these folks.
I understand that. But I guess, is there a way to understand the phenomenon so that you still preserve this, you know, the gist of the argument? And so, yes, we can take the ancient view as that, but indeed it was phenomenal.
Well, yes,
because
it was phenomenal.
Everything is phenomenal.
Okay.
And so it doesn't cut the power out of the argument away, I don't think.
Okay.
Tom is back, please.
My question is a little similar to what you're talking about, and that is, we know that the Hebrews use lots of figures of speech.
Excuse me. Yes.
There was lots of use of figures.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of examples like the image of God mentioned in Genesis 1.
Mm-hmm.
And many other examples. How do you differentiate it between what you're talking about as phenomenal language between the figures of speech that Hebrews frequently use? What's the distinction?
Well,
would you repeat the question? We're recording outside here. They'd like the questions repeated so they can have it on tape.
Oh, repeat the question. Sorry, I thought you were talking to the speaker. I mean, the person asked the question. Yes, if there's what would the distinction be between figurative language and phenomenal? How do we distinguish? How do we know it's not figurative language? And there's certainly some similarities there. I think it's just a difference of, you know, what we're looking at, although I just don't, you know, figurative language. I guess the writer in the Old Testament would know he was using figurative language, whereas I think with things like the sun and the moon and that they didn't recognize that, and so it's, they're not using it. I don't know else to say.
Did you have a hand? No? Okay.
Kurt, thanks, Paul, for your paper here. And If I got your definition of phenomenal language is language of appearance when the author really knew better.
Oh,
really knew,
well,
he was describing something different than the reality.
Not necessarily the author would know any better. It's we who know better.
Okay. We today?
Yeah. In other words, we're asking the question, when this Hebrew or Egyptian or Babylonian, when he talked about the sun moving, was he talking about what he thought was reality, or was he talking about just the appearance and he knew the reality was different?
Right.
And he doesn't know the difference.
Yeah. So, and I haven't read as much of Hodge and Calvin on this as you have, but the statements I've seen, I had the impression they use the term a little differently.
Uh-huh.
They use it to mean language of appearance, whether or not the original writer knew that it was, that he was describing something different than the noumenal.
There is that side, yes.
And so I think, you know, I would have called all of this phenomenal language, even if the author didn't know that he was using phenomenal.
In that sense, I think the same thing that Terry was driving at, and Hodge does do that. But for the discussion and for the rationalization that has gone on, the other distinction has to be made, and that's why we make it.
Sir, you and I have talked about this before, but now to have you in front of an audience, I can ask you. As you know, the Sumerians could see the seven planets. They called them the seven wanderers.
Correct.
They moved in different orbits than the stars, which may have been fixed.
Yes.
How would they have rationalized that these lights, whatever they were,
uh-huh,
could move on their own? If they were in a solid substance, it wouldn't be possible. And how would they think they were suspended if they were in front of a solid substance? I've never seen the logic of that. How would you explain that?
There's two possibilities. First of all, the Akkadian, at least, talks about the stars being inscribed onto the solid dome. And I think they knew that there was some moving also. So how exactly they did that, I don't really know. The other thing that is, I think, more, certainly I think applies to the sun and moon, is that to be in the firmament is not necessarily to be embedded in it. It could be, I mean, we're in this room, but we're not embedded in it. At least I think we'll be able to go afterwards. some of those, like sun and moon, and so they might have thought the planets were separated from the firmament in that way too. But the stars, they seem to think, were attached. I mean, the regular stars.
Yeah. I guess my question is, I like this historical grammatical approach in terms of absolute. But and that's my question to you then, is who's the original audience? Were they the scholars of the day, or were they the common people? And if so, is there a difference in terms of what they would have perceived in terms of what was the sort of, you know, what was the firmament? In other words, certainly the scholarly people had this model, which you might call a scientific model, but is that really what the common person would have understood, or was it?
Yeah, I'm confident it's what the common person would have understood, and I don't think the scholars had anything. I mean, you do have some possible differences in late periods, but I've never seen any evidence that there was any difference as far as the solid firmament is concerned. The scholars and the common people. See, that's an international. It's found amongst all peoples on all continents. They're just example after example after example. And they all regard the sky as solid, and thinkers and non-thinkers. And they incorporate, like I say, into their...
Is that a phenomenon? Like,
yeah.
Is that phenomenology? Right? In other words, you know, do they really have a model form, right? Or was this just, I look at the sky and it looks like it's solid, and that's...
No, this sky is absolutely solid. Yeah. They not only you don't see this a lot in the Mesopotamian and Egyptian, I mean, because it's just they don't write about this. But when you get into the primitive peoples around the world, the solid sky, they shoot arrows into it. They get hanging down and climb up to it. There are people on top that fall through it. There's pieces of sky that fall that are found on the ground. There's other explanations, like where do the geese go? The firmament lifts up. They go. We're not sure where they go, but they leave here. The firmament goes down. So have to be careful you're not around when it comes down again. That is actually stress there. Don't stay in there and get caught. So these are very literal, real sky to them. Okay, how does a literal, you say, or?
Yes, if you take a literal or an aliteral approach, how does that change the nature and the quality of claims that one can advance?
A literal or an amythological? I'm kind of missing something here.
All right, I'll use your terminology, phenomenological or literal. How does choosing one of those interpretive stances change the nature of the claims and the quality of claims that one can make?
So what I'm presenting, what does that do to the scripture and what claims we can make?
Yes.
Yeah. I think it has to be dealt with, you know, with particular issues. And where we have, like I say, a solid sky or a moving sun, and there are other issues like that, we have to recognize that the Bible is not, either God doesn't know any better, or God is not giving us a revelation about those particular subjects. And they run, I stated this phenomenal language thing, but there is the very second verse of Scripture, the great deep, that begins, there's nothing even created, God doesn't even create. Now, theologically, of course, theologians run around and quickly, God created that too. But in the ancient world, I don't think they even thought about that. This primeval sea was there before anything else was done. And that sea is divided into two and so on, both in Babylonian and in the Bible. But in modern terms, we think in terms of the earth beginning as a dry planet, too hot to have a sea. So we're just not getting a revelation of modern scientific truth in Scripture. John Walton went so far, and I certainly go this far, that all science in the Bible is the science of the times. So we have to, instead of having to worry of how do we make this science and the Bible agree, which is our natural impulse, we recognize, we're going to get somebody else that's going to disagree with that, I think. But instead of saying that, just forget it, it's all ancient science, and it would be an accident if it agreed.
Hey, our science is the science of the times.
That's true. Our science is the science of the times, too.
So We've got time for one more short question. Yes, sir, please.
In Revelation, John was told to write what he saw. Do you see that as an argument for phenomenological?
Told to write what he saw, huh? I don't know, I'd have to think about that one. That didn't cross my radar.
I'm going to cover that a little.
Oh, we got still more time. One more question, sir, please.
Regarding the motion of the sun around the earth?
Yes.
I'd like to give a perspective that I learned in the second grade.
Okay.
Good morning, Mary, sunshine. How did you wake so soon? You frightened all the stars away and shined away the moon. I saw you go to sleep last night before I quit my playing. How did you get way over there? And where have you been staying? I never go to sleep, dear child. I just go round to see my little children of the East who rise and watch for me.
Well, thank you.
I think that's a great way to end it.
Way to end it. Yeah, I should put that in here.
Thanks very much, Paul.
That was phenomenal.
That was phenomenal. It was literally phenomenal.
You need to give up the mic.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Thank you. Thank you.